ebook publishers and marketing services company, Just Imagine It, Inc. presents Get Behind Me, Now Stay There, your favorite fun-filled, informative podcast available on iTunes, PRX, and right here locally on KSKQ 89.5 FM, Ashland, Oregon, art and entertainment news and views. Today's podcast is brought to you by the fine folks at Downpour.com, the one stop for all your audio and digital book needs. Join the Downpour Audiobook Club and save up to 50% on digital downloads, exclusive member-only deals and promotions with no commitment, and you can cancel at any time. Only $9.99 per month. And be sure to check out our new book rental program. That's Downpour.com. On this episode, Zaina Mauricio's new album inspires women to feel comfortable with their bodies, while KJ Waters' new book has a modern woman time-traveling to a past where she fights for her rights. And Solitude Creek, by New York Times best-selling author Jeffrey Deaver, and our Downpour.com special feature right after the news you want to know.
I'm Charlie Stanton.
I'm Maya Seligman.
I'm Sarah Simerson.
I'm Holly Lorian Adams.
Hi, I'm Sean Mark Nipper.
And I'm Jerry Renfro. Here's a look at our top stories in the art and entertainment world. I love supergroups. I love it when musicians who are successful get together and do their own thing, like the Highwaymen, you know, it was like Willie Nelson and Johnny Cash and that. So I don't know if you guys heard, but Nick Littlemore from Empire of the Sun and Craig Nichols of the Vines have gotten together and they're doing kind of a little supergroup thing and they're going to release an album. They kind of got together and realized they had some music in them that didn't quite fit with the aesthetics of their current bands. And they recorded their first song called Give Up, Give Out, and Give In. And it'll be the first track for the album of the band called White Shadows. That's what they're going to call it. It's White Shadows. Pretty exciting. I love seeing that happen. It's like when you get a movie with a whole bunch of, you know, A-list actors, you know, even if they're doing like little parts. It's just something special about that because you know they're, you know, each one of them has their own thing, and then they come together and make something even better. It's pretty exciting.
I'm really looking forward to it, too, because I'm a big Vines fan, and they don't do a lot of, album after album or tour, mainly because Craig Nichols, their singer and songwriter, has a lot like Brian Wilson, episodic episodes in between albums, you know.
Goes and, off the rails for a little bit.
Yeah, but he's very creative, and as a matter of fact, let's hear a little bit of one of the White Shadow songs.
Every day the world is changing, can you hear the sound? And the way the people make it always gets me down. I don't even want to be here.
The Vines blew up, and they're from Australia. And they were just like, you know, if you guys all remember that song Ride With Me. You know, they're the ones that did that. And, Don't Listen to the Radio and things like that. So like Jerry was saying, you know, for when you get creative people together that are, you know, very creative on their own, and they come together, you know, and it works. Because sometimes it doesn't always work, you know. because of egos or different styles. But these guys just really meshed. Well, you know, they got into the studio and said, like, this is really sounding good. Let's continue it. And so I'm really looking forward to that, you know?
Yeah, and this is his first project outside of the Vines. So this is kind of his first chance to do something different. Because I think the Vines just their last album was their sixth album, that 22-track one, Wicked Nature.
Yeah.
I think originally this song was recorded by them as a group, but it was different. Like, it was a B-side single for Don't Listen to the Radio. If you're a Vines fan, really anybody should really like this.
Yeah,
it'd be really good to hear.
It's really good. He produced the whole thing himself, and that's why there's so many songs on it. He said, I'm just doing this for the fans. And, speaking of fans and stuff like that, there's this story that Maya has that just really blows my mind, man. And it is so cool. You've got to hear it.
I first saw it on Facebook and I thought, this is interesting. A recent art show really set off a bunch of shock and confusion and outrage in mainstream media because Richard Prince, he has a long history of taking images from other sources without permission and changing them really minimally, if at all, and then presenting them as his own work and selling them for a lot of money. And that's what happened at the Freeze Art Fair very recently. He presented a new set of Instagram pictures that were mainly taken from the feed belonging to Suicide Girls. I don't know if you know them, but
it's a
community of models and burlesque performers with a punk rock kind of aesthetic. Holly, you'd appreciate the burlesque part.
I do, actually. Facebook, huh? A friend of mine was going to go down and audition for Suicidal Girls this year, and so she got some new tattoo work done on her shoulder.
Oh, nice.
She's all ready to go down there, and then she checked the date after she had booked her tickets, and it was for last year.
Oh, bummer.
Brand new work and everything. But yeah, go on. I want to hear more.
So what Prince did is he took the Instagram pictures, he blew them up, jet printed them onto 6-foot canvases, and the only changes he made to the images were these cryptic remarks that he added to the comment threads. And so obviously this ended up being quite a controversy because Suicide Girls founder Selena Mooney, she's known as Missy Suicide, when she caught wind of it, she did a great thing. She opted for a different approach and she chose to reverse Mr. Prince's tactic. But she did it at an affordable price. So she did a 99.9% markdown. Nice. And she sold the same prints, instead of $90,000, which is how much he was charging, $90,000 per art piece, she was charging $90. And you can buy, you can buy them online. It's the same one. She's doing the same thing back. And they're donating the profits from their sales to the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, yeah. And so just after a day of availability, the Suicide Girls, they sold about 250 prints. People snapped them up. But it still is nothing compared to how much Prince is making.
And they were selling them for $99?
$99, yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. That's a great way that they handled it because, most people's instinct is going to be lawsuit. We're going to sue, copyrighted images, etc. I love that tactic.
Yeah, totally. And so what Missy Suicide said in a later interview, she says, Instagram is such an expression of our identity, and to have an old dude steal them and get paid such a significant fee for them hurt. And she said, we have seen more attention from media and have received tons of messages of support, and it's been a little overwhelming in a good way. So in some ways, it came back to them because they're in the news and they get the big spotlight for them. But still, it's quite interesting, especially with social media these days, of what ownership actually means.
Yes.
We end up reposting and things can oftentimes get misidentified as who the actual creator or owner is.
Yeah. I agree with Jerry on this one point. I think it's so cool. They turned it around in their favor and they're saying, look, we want people to appreciate our work, and we could take you to court and recap this money. But then we just look like another person that was just in it for the money. We're in it for the art. So you know what? You want the art? We'll give you the art.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when we post something on Facebook, isn't it in the fine print of what we agreed to as having in a Facebook account that they actually own the images to a certain extent?
No, they don't own them. You can go into your privacy settings and say, I only want it shown to these people or I want to make this public domain.
Yeah.
But Facebook doesn't own
you. You do not sign away your rights.
I'm not talking about visibility. I'm talking about that image, they are able to hold on to that image. Even if you close your account, they can hold on to it indefinitely and they can do what they want with it, maybe. I don't know.
They can hold on to the data, but they can't release it without your permission.
Right, uh-huh. And they can't use it. Like, they couldn't, if you took a picture of yourself smoking a Marlboro, they couldn't sell that image to Marlboro to use in their advertising. Uh-huh. It's not like that. Okay. They have the rights, when you use their service and you put it up there, they have the rights to hang on to it, yes. Uh-huh. And they have the rights to use it for their own internal purposes. So if they put together like a Facebook collage and you've made your stuff public, they could use your picture for that, but they couldn't use your picture. What he's doing is he's taking somebody else's property and using it to basically sell make his own product. Mm-hmm. And that would be where the illegality comes from.
Gotcha. Yeah, and like Facebook says, they collect the data, they have a great line. They go, we actually did a book here on this. We published a book and it was called I Know What You Did Last Summer and I Saw the Pictures. I thought it was going to be a mystery. And I started editing this book and it was all about Facebook. And it's like they said, we don't know anything about you that you don't tell us. And we don't post anything that you don't allow. He goes, but with the data we have, we keep it.
It makes me think of Sean here. I wonder if I own his image now since I took the picture, the funny picture of you with your party hats on, and I get to do my own art with it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So if I make an art piece and blow it up into a 6-foot canvas and sell it at an art show, would you have to get some of that?
No, because you took a picture of him. He owns the rights to his image. We were talking about selfies. If you took a picture of yourself, you own the rights to those image. If you take a picture of him, you don't have the right to turn it into an advertising campaign without him releasing the giving you a release to use it for that purpose.
But because I did it you are more than a 20% change. What's
doesn't that? You might, but you could get sued too. So
interesting.
I'm not going to sue you, by the way.
Well, in the picture I made of you, you have nice pecs. So.
Oh, thank you. And you did well. Thank you. I appreciate that for adding those. And you changed me 80%, so I'm not going to sue you for the. That's good.
Well, I tell you what. Holly and Sean have a story that, that I just can't wait, I've got a little personal connection to this, so I want to hear this story, and it's about a movie, of course. Let's hear about it.
Well, in a sleepy Californian desert sits an abandoned junkyard, an abandoned RV, and an abandoned young woman haunted by a secret. Sounds like a story about bereavement and atonement and redemption. We're following one woman's journey into finding forgiveness after the tragic loss of her family. And it's talking about the story of Sandboy. Sandboy is an homage to a grief brought to life on screen with fictional characters and scenarios. Grace is an outsider artist imprisoned by the desert of her mind. Full of longing and regret, Grace punishes herself for the horrific events that took place last Christmas. And as the film unfolds, we slowly come to realize that Grace holds herself responsible for the tragic death of her husband, child, and an innocent woman. Really moving and epic film. Director Vittorio Colonna and producer Rachel Lysaught and Lindsay and Jade from the Underground Films have worked on this together, as well as a note that Julian Lennon was the executive producer.
Huh.
So I'd love to hear more about what your close connection to this is, Charlie. And we're really
well. The thing is like, I brought this to Sean, originally, and I was telling him this, right? Because first of all, the actress who plays the lead, and she does a fantastic job. You can see the trailer on YouTube. It's an independent film, which is something that, is your forte.
Right.
My connection with it is that I got the information on it from Jules, and I happen to be friends with him. And he stepped in. They did an Indiegogo campaign and Kickstarter campaign, right, to get funding for the film. And they couldn't get enough money because they wanted, to be a really good film. And they got a lot of money, but not, that kind of money. And they, they pitched it to him, and he saw it, and he said, "Yeah." He goes, "I'll back it." He goes, "Not only will I back it, I'll advertise it." And he advertised it for them, on his Facebook page and on his website. And he went to the New York premiere where she won for the best actress in New York City, for the film. So that's my deal with it.
That's fantastic. Yeah, it's really hard to make money and try to get your project out there on Indiegogo and the Kickstarter campaigns. It's I feel like it's more about inventions and products and people. Unless you really have a compelling story and are able to convey that in that little 2.5 minutes that you have on Kickstarter or Indiegogo, it's really difficult to get backed. And anymore, really, I think Kickstarter and Indiegogo are more about the promotion and marketing and less about making money, so I've noticed. And so, yeah, it's really good to have a backer. That's really the best way to go about getting your movie funded, because it's just tough. You got to have a huge social network, and God bless them for you know, raising enough money and then finding the right person to back it. So that's exciting.
Yeah, it was really cool. You know, when Jules was saying that, you know, he goes, I saw, you know, what they shot and I liked it, you know, and he goes, I liked it so much that I said, yeah, I'll give you the money to do it, you know. And, he goes, I don't want to have anything to do with the project and I'm not going to write music for it or anything like that, you know. But, you know, we'll make it happen. They filmed in Barstow, California, but they went to New York City looking for backers, and that's when they ran into Jules. You know, and he does a lot of projects like this because that's just the kind of guy he is, you know. Right. He's very talented, but he's also into a lot of political things just like his father was. And he also is a photographer, professional photographer too. So he's at a lot of these, you know, different events. So he's accessible.
Where are they in the project now? Has it been completed yet?
The movie is done, and she won Best Actress, and you know, at the New York Independent Film Festival. Oh, so you know, okay. You know, it's done quite well. You know.
Yeah. Great looking sushi. Yeah. That's a great input. Yeah.
Speaking of New York, Cyrus has got a really kick-ass story.
This is
crazy.
This is pretty wild. I never would have thought of this, but somebody has. You know, the other day, 70 musicians showed up at Grand Central Terminal vying for permission to set up their underground acts for tips. They appeared before a jury of musicians and transit employees in the elegant Vanderbilt Hall above the train tracks. This year's Motley musical crew featured countries around the world, and we'll soon find out who won the right to be part of the Music Underground New York program run by the Metropolitan Transportation Authority, which operates the nation's biggest mass transit system. 300 performers entered the Music Under New York contest months ago to be selected for the live 6-hour contest. The jury picks about 24 winners, who will rake in up to hundreds of dollars a day when they're dispersed at subway spots around the city. It's illegal for unapproved artists to perform in the subway system.
That makes it something you can put on a resume now.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I was good enough to be picked to play on, you know, the L Street station.
They should do, like, an American Idol show.
American Idol New York Subway Edition. Totally show. Love it.
That would be crazy.
Yeah, that's probably where they get half their people anyway. When they, you know, with the rejects from American Idol go over there.
Right, right.
No, but the thing, you know, the thing is, man, I don't know the last time you were in New York, you know, but I'll tell you a funny story, man. We was down there in the subway, and this guy was in there with his guitar, and he was actually pretty dang good, you know? And I don't know if you all remember that song, Wonderwall by Oasis.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
After all, you're my Wonderwall.
Where Were You by We Were Getting High, you know, right? So this guy's playing the guitar and he's singing the song. And Liam Gallagher from Oasis, you know, who is the singer from the song, and his brother wrote it, right? They were in New York making an album, right? And they were going through the subway and they heard this guy and they walked up to him, right? And he goes, hey, May, you sound fantastic, mate. And he goes, oh, thank you. Thank you so much, man. You know, and he goes, how do people respond to this? And he goes, man, he goes, it pays my rent. And then Gallagher says, yeah, it's been paying my rent for years.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, it's so funny.
I mean, but it's like, you know, if you go to subway system, man, or if you're in London and you go to the tubes and stuff like that, you know, that's what they call the subway system there. It's a whole different world, man, you know, and it's so cool. And the difference between New York, like here in Ashland, we have a lot of street musicians that play and sit and stuff like that.
You know,
sometimes they're really good, you know, and sometimes, you know, they just seem like they're down on their luck. But the thing that the people dig in the subway, you know, is that, one, the acoustics are really great.
Mm.
And two, they're heavily patrolled.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because at the Ashland Co-op, I just found out that it is against the rules for them to put out a hat to collect money, but they can play the music. And then I saw that Whole Foods, I can't remember where, but they have something where they have a different artist that performs every day. Like they have a schedule of artists that can collect money in front of Whole Foods.
Oh, our farmer's market is that way now. You have to go in advance and you say what kind of music you're going to play, and then they give you your slot and they tell you what side of the market you can stand on. It's very organized. Our own Ashland Market or Rogue Valley Market, I guess they do it at all of them now.
The Grover's Market.
The Saturday Market.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
You have to schedule to busk.
Maybe I'm in the minority here, man, but I'm kind of like more of like, look, man, if you're out there playing and you open up your guitar case, you put out your hat, you know, and you're doing magic tricks or whatever, I don't think there's anything wrong with somebody going, hey, man, you know, here's a buck. You know,
you're providing a service. Yeah. You're performing, you're providing a service, and there's no reason that people shouldn't be allowed to compensate you for that service.
Here's $20. Stop playing, man. We're trying to have people out there.
You mean you didn't get any record deals, Charlie?
No. Well, somebody offered to break a record over my head, but...
What a big deal it is if a couple people stop, because, you know, this is New York. Everybody's got somewhere to be and they need to be there 10 minutes ago. You know, so if you can get two or three people to stop and listen to you for a few minutes, that's a huge ego boost for these guys. You know what I mean? Like, they know they're doing something right. So, yeah.
Especially if they whip out their iPhones to start filming.
They start filming it, yeah. Exactly.
Because smartphones can sure do a lot.
Yeah, you know, and, you know, that's funny you would mention that. Smartphones can do a lot. I was thinking along the same lines. Well, you know, with the proliferation of smartphones, iPads, tablets, and things like that, modern parents are faced with a dilemma, and that's how much do you monitor your kids' activity? You know, when I was a kid, the phone was in the kitchen. So there were no secret phone calls. Nobody sent me nudie pics on the home phone. You know, that was not a concern my parents had to have. But these days with sexting, cyberbullying, you know, the things that are done on Facebook. So parents are faced with this dilemma. What do you do? And there's a number of options out there, but this one that I was reading about is called TeenSafe, a service. It's $15 a month called TeenSafe, and it essentially allows parents to monitor texts sent, received, and deleted, as well as their kids' online activity, web surfing, and activity on like Facebook, WhatsApp, you know, Instagram, etc. You know, the parents still have to log in. They have to actively look and see. What do you guys think?
Well, you know what? I have two daughters, that are 10 and 12, and they both have smartphones. I haven't gotten this app or anything like that, because I just haven't, you know. But I have mixed emotions about it because it's like, one, you know, I'm, you know, was always raised, you know, that privacy is a big thing. You don't open up other people's mail, you know, and... you know, you don't read over their shoulders or try to get into the personal, you know, space. But at the same time, you know, it's so easy to lure, you know, and it's not just little girls, you know, it's you know, children, you know, into either, you know, something, you know, sordid and sexual or something illegal or making them think that something's really cool that's not really cool, like drugs, you know? And then there's the peer pressure that goes with it and the bullying and all that stuff. So I'm kind of like sitting on the fence with it. My solution would be like, you know, is to tell them I have the app.
Yes.
And
I have,
you know,
this ability.
I have the app and actually get it. And then read one day, right? And then tell them, you know, like, yeah, I read, you know, one day, you know, and I know that you're going to Melissa's party on Saturday, you know. You know, what do you want to get her, right? And then they'll be all upset, like, Dad, why'd you do that, right? But then, you know, then you don't have to do it anymore and say, look, I'm not going to do it, you know, all the time. But it's just kind of like, you know, them knowing that, you know what, I better behave myself. It's like almost like the police out there, you know. It's like you don't see them every day, but you know that they're there.
Yeah. I know a parent who did that, and it worked. We should be teaching our children to have smart skills around using the internet. We shouldn't be telling them we're going to peek over their shoulder.
Have them be smart thinkers.
I think it's a balance of both, man. It's like, you know what, I can get into it. So like with my daughters, you know, I tell them, you know, I'm not getting into your stuff, you know, but the thing is like, you know, this is the long-winded point I was going to make is that, you know, like I went in, you know, and, you know, put the parental controls in for no in-app purchasing. Well, they just went back in and turned it back on because they know more about computers than we do.
Well, right. I mean,
you know,
for
they
years,
grew up with them.
Years,
you know?
Kids have been setting the clock on our VCRs and our DVD players, and you know, hey, you know, come here, you know, 4-year-old, show me how to run this computer.
So what I did, came up with a solution, which is not as drastic as this app, is this, man. You know, I told my one daughter, who I will not mention her name because she will kill me and they listen to the show. You know, I told her, so look, you know, she, you know, called me up from, you know, and it, not on her on her smartphone. But from the home line, and she called my cell phone, right? And she tells me, she goes, hey, my phone's not working. I don't know what's wrong with it, you know? And I go, I know what's wrong with it. And she goes, what's that? I called our service provider, and I told her to turn that number off for a week. And she goes, what? You know? And I go, yeah. I go, look, I told you, I don't know how many times, I don't want you doing this, and you keep doing it, so now the phone's off for a week. And when it goes back on and you do it again, maybe we'll make it a month. So it's kind of like, you know, grounding them from their phone, you know?
Wow.
They can't change the password, and they're a minor. They can't call up AT&T and say, I want that phone turned back on, you know?
Wow.
So that was my solution.
Brutal.
I mean, but computers have changed the world tremendously. And
some of them are worth quite a bit.
Yeah.
That's right. Well, we're talking about modern technology, but it started with the Apple One. I didn't even know about this. And it turns out that there was quite an event that happened. So electronic waste could be someone else's treasure. There was a recycling center in the Silicon Valley who is now looking for a woman who dropped off an old Apple computer that turned out to be a collectible item worth $200,000.
Whoops.
Yep, it was inside boxes of electronics that she'd cleaned out from her garage after her husband passed away. And she didn't want a tax receipt or anything. She didn't leave her contact information. And a couple weeks later, the workers at the recycling center, they opened the boxes to discover an Apple One computer inside. There were only about 200 first-generation desktop computers, and it was assembled by Steve Jobs, Steve Wozniak, and Ron Wyant in 1976.
Wow.
Yeah.
In their garage.
Yeah, crazy. At first, the people at the recycling center, they thought it was a fake. It was like, no, how can it be like that? But they ended up selling the Apple for $200,000 to a private collection. And because that company gives 50% of items sold back to the original owner, right now the center wants to split the proceeds with the mystery donor, but they just need to track her down. So the owner remembers what she looks like, but they have no way of calling her back, except hopefully she sees it in the news.
Maybe hears it on our show.
Yeah, you know what? That's a great story because, like, one, you know, I know you're particularly fond, you know, of yard sales and stuff like that. So you never know what you're going to find. But I think it's even, you know, even more cool that these guys are like, hey, we got 200 grand here. And we're trying to find the owner and split it with her.
Split it. Give her the money.
Yeah. Wow.
What if it's Maya's doppelganger? I think we should go down there. I'll drive. I'll drive us down there, Maya. Let's see. Which is, I mean, we got a chance. And how many people? 7.2 billion people chance. Well,
I'll tell you what, man. There's one guy that was around when the Apple One was built, and that was Clint Eastwood.
He was definitely around. I mean, he's 85 now.
Is he really?
Yeah, he just had his birthday on May 31st.
Doesn't look a day over 84, man.
Well, you know, I bet there's six things that you didn't know about Clint Eastwood. One is that he doesn't only direct and act, he's also a composer and a pianist, and he sings. So he did the music for Mystic River, Million Dollar Baby, Flags of Our Fathers, Grace Is Gone, Changeling, and J. Edgar, and the original composition for the piano in The Line of Fire. So
I didn't know that, man.
Right? I know. I had no idea he was a singer. He also did the last song in the credit rolls of Gran Torino. And he taught himself how to play the piano well enough to get to Carnegie Hall, which makes me wonder, do you think he's good enough to play in the New York subway?
Probably.
I think we should try to, we should check that out. So that's number one. So number two, he did the empty chair speech at the big Republican.
I remember that.
That was hilarious.
Oh, man. And so after that, it kind of became a thing. It's called Eastwooding.
Yeah, they became a meme.
Yeah,
online.
Which I thought Eastwooding was something completely different until I realized that it's this. People are taking pictures of themselves talking to a chair. Thank you for laughing at that. Thank you. It's awesome. I haven't had a chance to do it, but I'm going to take a picture of myself with this chair that I'm sitting in.
Okay.
When we're done here. He used to be the mayor of Carmel by the Sea.
I knew that.
Yeah. And he used to have a restaurant there. I've actually eaten at his restaurant.
Was it good?
Yeah, it was fantastic. Nothing but steak.
I visited Carmel while I was mayor once.
Did you?
Yeah, and that was what we talked about the whole time. Can you believe Clint Eastwood is the mayor?
Well, can you believe that he actually repealed the ban to sell and eat ice cream in public while he was mayor?
That was like his big running point. Like, elect me mayor and I'll let you eat ice cream on the beach.
Well, unfortunately, he didn't get a second term. And the community still prohibits the wearing of high heels without a permit.
Oh, come on, Clint. The city needs you, man.
You're going to have to call City Hall.
Criminal.
You're going to have to call City Hall for those heels you're wearing today. So that was number three. Actually, he turned down a role of James Bond.
Yeah, he was offered the James Bond part.
Right. And I think it was because the guns were too small.
Couldn't imagine Eastwood with a little Walther. That's funny.
And didn't he also turn down Superman?
He did. Yeah, he turned down Superman. As well, and that would have been amazing. That would have been super interesting. And five, he has a soft spot for historical buildings. He likes the Mission Ranch in Carmel. He has that.
Right.
And then, of course, he didn't only say, go ahead, make my day. How was that? Was that good? That was my impression. He also said, I have a strict gun control policy. If there's a gun around, I want to be in control of it. And he said, nothing wrong with shooting as long as the right people get shot. So God bless
Sounds
you.
Sounds Republican.
85. Yeah, it's such a, yeah. He's all about the Second Amendment for sure. So
yeah, you know what? He is, he's such a fascinating character, and you know, he is a great director. I saw a couple movies he directed, The Million Dollar Baby and the one on Iwo Jima, which I thought was a fantastic concept because he did it from the Japanese point of view.
Yeah, Letters from Iwo Jima.
Yeah, Letters from Iwo Jima. Yeah, and he's really, really good at it. And I saw him on Jimmy Fallon, right, just recently, and you were talking to him, and asked him about directing, does he prefer directing now or as to acting? And he goes, I can do either one, you know, depends on the movie, because he had just done that movie about baseball. But I won't get into that because everybody
cringes. Trouble with the Curve.
But, Trouble with the Curve. And he was talking to him, and he goes, yeah, you know, he goes, you know, you're a legend, you know, and you know, you're still, you know, at 85, you know, making movies, that's so great, and everything like that. And he goes, I hope I do that. And he started asking about these actors he's worked with and stuff like that. And he goes, like, you know, he goes, you work with Paul Newman? And he goes, yeah, I work with Paul Newman, yeah, a lot, and stuff like that. And he goes, yeah, I must have been hard on you guys, you know, when he goes, when Paul Newman passed away. And he goes, why would it be hard on me? And he goes, well, I thought you guys were good friends. He goes, we were good friends. He goes, he died. He was 80 years old. He had a nice life.
Yeah, you're done. Yeah. Oh, my God.
Well, Paul McCartney's got 13 years to go to get to 85.
Oh!
You're good at math.
But, you know, he's got a great fitness routine that should probably get him there. But it's not what you would expect, you know. Not only does he go to the gym, but his routine includes a 5-minute headstand that he's been doing for the last 50 years. So, according to him, he feels pretty good. So I guess it's been working. You know, McCartney is an example of clean living. He's a longtime vegetarian who takes care of his body, and he's even given up his one vice, which he was famously arrested for in the early 80s, which is smoking
teenagers.
Pot. Oh. So, you know, now he just has a glass of wine or a margarita or something. So as long as he keeps doing his headstands and, you know, staying fit, yeah, he should be able to get to 85, no problem.
Charlie always does his headstands. I just see him doing that all the time.
Yeah, I do that quite
often.
So
no wonder you look so young.
Yeah, man. Well, you know, last time I did my headstand, you know, I broke my shoulder, so... You know, but I think it's amazing, you know, that he's in such good shape, you know, a guy this age.
Yeah, 72 years old, and he plays with younger musicians. He's always around younger people, you know, so he's got to be able to, you know, stay fit and active, you know, to keep up with the
bands. Yeah, and I like that fact that he was saying about that, you know, that why is he standing on his head? And he said it was a yoga thing he learned in the 60s, probably when they went to India. And he said he just kept it up, and he likes going to the gym in New York, you know, where his wife has her job. She's a yoga instructor. And he goes, I see all these guys there, and they're all, you know, lifting the weights, trying to get buff, stuff like that. And he goes, I'm not trying to get strong. I just want to, you know, be limber enough and have enough energy, you know, to bounce around stage. And he says he always has fun with the younger guys. At the end of his workout, he does a headstand, and he challenges everybody, let's do it. And nobody else can do it but him. And that's your art and entertainment news.
Keep listening for Downpour's special feature.
Here in my room, just thinking of you. Things would get better if you get here soon. Nothing to do, just playing your fool. But you change the weather whenever you are near to me. It all comes clear to me.
Zaina Mauricio's new album, Rock the Natural, has her feeling beautiful. She talks about it with the president of Just Imagine It, Inc., Charlie Stanton, in this interview.
Love that guy.
Welcome, everybody, to a really exciting interview on Get Behind Me Now, Stay There. Today, we're really honored to have Zaina Mauricio, and she is just one hell of a singer, man. And she's here to talk with us about all of her new projects she's got going on. And I know you got a show coming up in Illinois, and for all of you that's in the middle of the United States, and all our listeners around the world. Hey, welcome, and how are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing really good. You know, I love your music, and you know, and a lot of people do. You know,
thank you so much.
So how did you get into this? You know, I mean, it seems like, you know, when I listen to and I watch your videos and stuff, I'm like, you know, man, you sound like you've been, look like you've been doing this all your life.
Yeah, I was singing in church since I was like eight years old.
Uh-huh.
I was singing in church, you know, like the Sunday school, and then from choir to all my life. But it was African choir, you know, African church. So just 3 years ago, in 2012, when I graduated my bachelor degree,
uh-huh.
I was like, finally, because my dad didn't want me to be a singer, actually. And I'm like, you know what, I'm going to give you the degree that you want, and as soon as I'm done, I'm going to have to be doing music.
You're going to have to be you. You're going to have to be what you want to be, yeah, follow your dream.
Music. So graduated and told my dad, yeah, like now I professionally do music.
And so your album is Rock the Natural?
Yeah.
And where did you come up with that title?
Okay, so you know like how everybody's doing twerking, everybody's doing, you know, like...
Right.
...of everything going on. Like everybody's is having this unnatural body and everybody's like, okay, I'm going to have to get the boob done. I'm going to have to get this done because they're not comfortable no more with their beauty. So I'm like, well, I need to write something about that because that's not fair. I'm proud of who I am. I'm proud of how I look.
Oh, well, you're very beautiful, and it's a really good point, too, that you bring up.
I feel like it's wrong, because I feel like if you embrace your body, I think if you embrace your body and you love yourself, you become truthful to you. If you put those fake stuff and fake this, fake that, by tomorrow, you're going to have a problem with it, because by the end of the day, what happened to you? You know, you are not who you think you were anymore, because you have lost who you are, because you have owned some other stuff that is not even you.
Yeah, you know what? Yeah, I can hear you. And that was a good comment, because, you know, from a man's point of view, I've always held the opinion that every woman is beautiful. You know, and it doesn't matter what woman you look at, they all have something special, you know?
Yeah, and you have to understand, if another guy told me I don't look good, that's not mean that I'm ugly. It's because I'm not the type of girl he likes. So that's fine with me, because each and everybody has somebody who knows and who look at them some type of way, like, oh my gosh, she's beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think because, you know, I just also, like, let's look at high school when we have these young girls. I also think of, like, when you are a cheerleader and other people are in another community and they look so cute, and so they want to be, because of the other person looks so cute and they want to be popular, and that's, you know, it takes them to do all those fake. I mean, I don't say it's bad. Everybody makes their own decision on what they want to do. If you want to put fake boobs and everything else, or bad, whatever, it's okay with them. But to me, I'm like, I understand everybody's praising that. So what happened to the beauty girl? Like, you know, to natural beauty.
Yeah, it's still there. And, you know, I applaud you for doing that. You know, okay, like you have a song out, you know, called Until the Sky Falls. And I just love that song.
Oh, yeah. Oh, thank you.
And a matter of fact, let's hear a little bit of it right now.
Show us the music in your ear. Then I play a song to bring you here. Maybe I'll be a little man. Maybe I'm beyond all repair. But you see the thing about it is, until you come back to me, I will want the hands of time. From the desert.
So, like, you know, what I'm saying is that, you know, that song is beautiful, and you know, it's going to endure way past, you know, everyone's physical beauty. You know, as an older gentleman myself, it's funny when I look back on pictures of me, you know, when I was in my 20s and 30s, and I was just like, what was I thinking, you know?
Right.
You know, because right. We all just, everything, it's just a constant change, you know?
Right.
But the music has a life of its own. And so, like, you know, it's a cliche that it's a universal language, but it really is.
It does. It is. Wow. Thank you so much. I like Until the Sky Falls. So strong and powerful.
It is. Oh, really? It is.
I'm normally a pop dance EDM kind of singer.
Uh-huh.
And then I was like, when I was doing the EP for Six Song, I told my producer, you know what, I want to have some slow music, you know, like one or two slow, touchy music. He's like, no, we should just do the pop ones, because, you know, my accent, is it brings a lot of challenging. To see that you understand what I'm singing is hard for me, because sometimes the way I pronounce things is different from, you know, from how another person pronounced, and sometimes it's harder to understand me, so I have to work a little bit harder.
Oh, I think it's cool. I don't, you know. No, I really do. I think it's cool. You know, I mean, all the different accents around the world, man. That's you know, the beauty of it, man. You know. Yeah. So you're gonna be going to out on tour.
Yeah, Chicago. Yeah. Yes.
And what do you prefer doing? Do you prefer working in the studio, or do you like touring better?
Actually, you know what? That's funny. That's a good question. I am better in life. I like live music. I like touring. I like performing a lot. I'm more of a performer than in the studio artist. I like the fact that nowadays I produce. I can produce myself. I can be in the studio, write my own music and record it, and I can send it to the producer to mix it and mastering. But I'm a very shy person. I'm more comfortable when I'm in my zone, like in a little box.
Uh-huh.
You know, yeah, you know, like when a kid is in a box and playing, they create all those mommy, daddy story. So people, they kind of pull it back. That's how I am. Like when I'm writing my music, I just want to be alone and do things by myself. But if I'm with a producer and the microphone there, it's like it's more challenging than be on live. I just think like I'm more of a performer. I prefer. I'm comfortable more.
Yeah, you know, I could see where that would be the case. Are you like most artists? When I ask them, you know, what's their favorite album? You know, and they, you know, you guys have all done a lot of albums, and then they always say to me, "It's my latest one. That's the one I like the best."
I think it happens a lot because I have favorite songs. I have favorite songs like "Your Love" is reggae songs that are like it was my first kind of my first singles. I wrote it and I like it. And when I listen to it back and I, you know, I feel the same feelings. And if I was crying, then I mean, if I was crying, then when I was writing it, I feel the pain. Yes, every time when you write something, the one that you're working right now is the one that's your favorite. That's how it works.
Oh, okay.
I don't know why, but yes, right now my favorite is the song that I'm working on, which is Rock the Natural right now.
Rock the Natural. Let's hear some of the Rock the Natural right now so we can all get on the groove, man. Rock the Natural. Now that is a real, like, you know, it makes you want to get up and dance, you know, like, and, you know.
Actually, it's my first time. That's why I say breakthrough hip-hop. I don't sing hip-hop songs. Never. That's my first time.
You know, as they say, man, you hit it out of the ballpark or your very first try. That's, you know.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Well, tell everybody where your music is available. How can they get a hold of your music?
Actually, if you go to Zaina now, you can get everything, like my old music, all my videos, all my iTunes. Like if you click on the video, on the song, it can take you straight to the, you know, there, everything, like all my information, my bio, my pictures, my latest pictures, my new song.
All right. We'll be all looking forward to that. You can check out her videos there and get, you know, any of her really, really cool albums. And but follow her on Instagram, you know, man, it's been such a blast having you on. I want to thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to speak with us today.
Thank you for having me. Thank you very much. I'm excited. And I feel good for supporting my music and especially supporting this Beauty Natural. And also tell your girls, they should listen to the song.
Okay.
I know they will be very connected to somehow telling somebody else, you don't like how I look just get away because you really don't like me for who I am.
Okay.
You like me for who I am.
All right. I'll tell them that, and I'm sure they'll enjoy your music.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, and have a beautiful day out there.
To learn more about Zaina Mauricio, visit us on our website at justimagineinc.com.
It's a freaky show. Take a look at the old man, beating up the wrong guy. Oh man, wonder if you'll ever know who's in the best-selling show. Is there life on Mars?
K.J. Waters' new novel, Stealing Time, begins an amazing time-traveling trilogy. She talks all about it with the president of Just Imagine It, Inc., Charlie Stanton, in this interview.
Welcome, everybody, to a really exciting interview that we're going to have here today with K.J. Waters. And she is an author and so much more. And she has a new book out called Stealing Time. And welcome, K.J. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
You know, unbelievable. You know, I've read your book, and I really, really, really got into it, man, which I got to tell you is big compliment to you because, you know, we interview a lot of people, and we get sent a lot of stuff, you know. Every once in a while, we get something, and then I start reading it, and I'm just like, you know, wow, I can't put this down.
Good. I'm so glad. This is just what an author wants to do.
Yeah.
9 years of writing has paid off. You were happy. That makes me very happy.
So tell me, where did you come up with this idea? And tell our listening audience around the world here, you know, a little bit about the story. And we know it's about time traveling.
Yeah. It starts with Ronnie Andrews has just moved from Virginia Beach to Florida. And 3 days later, Hurricane Charlie hits. And during the storm, they know it's approaching, and she's with her best friend, Stephanie McKay, and they're deciding what to do. Ronnie ends up going into her boyfriend's weather lab. And during the storm, she somehow ends up going back in time to 1752 London. She has no idea how she got there. And she's not really, people think she's a Regina, and she doesn't really understand that. And later on, you'll see as the reader why that is. But she's put into a place where they did not treat women very well. In 1752, women were more like possessions. So she has a lot of struggles being a modern woman trying to, you know, fit into this new world. And in the meantime, she's trying to get out of it, trying to get back to Florida. And the other part of the story follows Stephanie McKay, who is her best friend, who's Scottish, but they both live there in Florida. And she invites her friend Nick over to be with her during the storm. And she gets out in the middle of the hurricane, and everything happens, like, essentially ends up getting worse and worse for Stephanie. And finally, she's, you know, at a point where I can't tell you what, because almost everything is lost for her. So it's a very, I spent a lot of time just trying to make it, each chapter wrap up with a hook so that the reader was like, oh my God, what's going to happen next? And, you know, to keep it, the pace really fast. And there's a lot of layers I've woven in there. I spent a whole, like I said, 9 years. So I've had time to, the character development, the storyline, historical research. It's not a flat story. There's so many things going on. And I'm glad to hear that you really liked it, because that was what I was hoping. I enjoy reading it still, just because there's so many different pieces in there.
Yeah, no, I have to wholeheartedly agree with you. And it's that, like with most books and most people when we read, you know, we're always, you know, fast forward in our minds, like, okay, I know what's happening next, or I've got this figured out. And with yours, I was just like, oh, come on, man. I never even saw that coming.
That's awesome. That was my sister yesterday who went to Hawaii. I feel so bad for her. But she was on the plane, and, you know, she heard me talk about my book. And I think most people that know me, you know, they've heard about this book for so long. It's like, it's, you know, it's finally out. It's been 9 years. So some of the excitement is, you know, they're excited I have a book. But she was reading it, and she just said the same thing. She's like, I couldn't believe where it went. There were so many places where I had a, you know, an inkling of where it was going to go, and it went the opposite direction. So it's great to hear you say that too. You know, the more people that read it and give me feedback, I feel like I did something right, you know?
Well, I would certainly agree with that. You did something right. It's an excellent book. It's a lot of fun. Read, you know, the read is really fun. And here's my barometer. When I'm getting towards the end and I'm like, you know what, I'm going to put this thing down because, you know, I don't want it to end. That's...
that's I know exactly how I'm feeling. You're like, don't...
But it's going to be a trilogy, right?
Yes. I've already got... When I wrote the book, over the 9 years, I wrote a very long book and I realized that it was just too big for the market. Science fiction novels are a certain length. And it was just too many things going on. I mean, you think there's a lot going on in this part. This is just the first third of it, right? So when I did that, I wrote probably up till midway through the second book and then figured out the rest of it. And I had to decide where to split the two and turn it into two separate books. So I've got most of book two written. It's just not nicely written. You know, you got to go back and organize it and then do all the little detail work, like I was saying, adding the layers and the twists. And in book one, I've added a lot of things that are teasers for the second book, like things that will be a complete twist that I've written into book one, so that when you go to the book two section of this and it goes back to that one scene in book one, hopefully will blow your mind, because it's I've really planted a lot of little things that twist and turn like that. So.
Well, you know, I'm sure it will. I don't think it'll blow my mind because it's already been blown. But, but you know, I love the book, and I love the fact it's going to be a trilogy, and it's doing very well. You know, it's available on Amazon and Barnes and Nobles and all the other book retailers, and of course we'll have it on our site. Now, but I wanted to ask you a little bit about, you know, what made you decide to become an author, because you have an extensive background.
Yeah, well, that's a good question. I was director of marketing for a national healthcare company. I did all kinds of branding, all that kind of stuff. And when I had my second child, I decided that I didn't really want to have the traveling, busy life, so I wanted to be home with my kids. And once I did that, it was great, but my mind was full of so many things. I needed a creative outlet. So I read Diana Gabaldon's Outlander series and absolutely fell in love with it. And it was so creative and so intelligent and so, you know, has the time travel element, has the historical element. So that's pretty much what inspired me. I read a book of hers called The Outlandish Companion. And it has a lot of character setups and backgrounds and stuff. But one chapter in there is talking about how she writes. And the way that she explained it, it just opened up a door for me. She said that she writes a scene and then she writes a completely unrelated separate scene. And then she connects all these pieces together. It wasn't this detailed outline, this very structured approach, which would drive me nuts. I mean, that's just not who I am. And so I thought, shoot, if she can do it that way and be so successful and have such an interesting book, why can't I try that? And in terms of the subject matter, I mean, the time travel element, I've always been fascinated with that. And as an author, I mean, how exciting is it to play with that? You can do anything. You can go anywhere. You can, you know, create whatever worlds you want with that. But the background setting, I had lived in Virginia Beach, and I moved to Florida, and 3 days later, Hurricane Charlie hit.
Oh, wow. And so we can find you on Twitter.
Yep. I'm at... Kamajowa, Kamajowa, and I apologize for that.
Okay.
Facebook, KJ Waters. I've also have the blog is Blondie in the Water. It's you can either Google that or it's kjwatersauthor.blogspot.com. And what I've done recently with the blog too is I'm doing author interviews.
Uh-huh.
People that I know that have written some good books, and I do a little excerpt and a little chance for readers to, you know, check out their work as well. Also, you know, the book, as you said, was on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, iTunes, Scribd, Kobo, Page Foundry, Inkterra, and Smashwords, and Create Space. So on my blog, I have all of that. If anyone just wants to look up KJ Waters and find the blog, they can find all the links. And I'm redoing my website. I have a very basic, lame website right now, but I'm trying to make it fancy and pretty. So that'll be out soon with all of the links and everything.
Well, it sounds like you're doing everything right, and the most important thing you've done was written a wonderful, wonderful book. It's highly recommended, and we recommend all of our listeners go out there and pick up a copy of Stealing Time by KJ Waters. It's been such a blast having you on. I got to tell you, man, it's like a breath of fresh air.
And thank you so much. It's been a lot of fun, and I'm so glad that you liked the book. That means a lot to me.
No, I really did, you know?
I'm so glad. That's great news for me.
To learn more about KJ Waters, visit us on our website at justimagineinc.com.
strong, cause my mind is fading. And everywhere I look, there's a dead end waiting. Temperature's dropping at the rotten oasis, stealing kisses from the leprous faces.
Solitude Creek. New York Times bestselling author Jeffrey Deaver's blockbuster thriller featuring returning character Catherine Dance. A tragedy occurs at a small concert venue on the Monterey Peninsula. Cries of fire are raised and panicked people run for the doors, only to find them blocked. Half a dozen people die and others are seriously injured. But it's the panic and the stampede that killed. There was no fire. Catherine Dance, a brilliant California Bureau of Investigation agent and body language expert, discovers that the stampede was caused intentionally, and the perpetrator, a man obsessed with turning people's own fears and greed into weapons, has more attacks planned. She and her team must race against the clock to find where he will strike next before more innocents die.
She works miracles, does she? Foster asked. This kinesics stuff? Catherine's good, yes.
Overby had taken a dislike to his colleague from Sacramento, who was the sort who'd snatch credit and press time away from those who'd done much of the legwork. He had to be careful, though. Foster was roughly on Overby's level, pay grade-wise, but higher up in the sense that he was based in Sacramento and had an office no more than 30 feet from the head of the CBI. Foster was also within lobbing distance of the legislature. Allerton adjusted her yellow pad, tore off and discarded the first page, and then wrote on the new top sheet, 1. Overby continued,
"Funny. When you know what she does, that body language stuff, then you go out to lunch with her, you watch what you're doing, where you're looking. Like you're waiting for her to say, 'So you had a fight with your wife this morning, hmm? Over bills, I'd guess.'"
"Sherlock Holmes," Allerton said. She added, "I like that British one. With the guy with the funny name, like Cummerbund?" Overby, staring into the interrogation room, said absently,
"That's not how kinesics works." "No?"
from Foster. Overby said nothing more. As the others gazed through the glass, he in turn examined the two members of the Guzman Connection task force present at the moment. Foster. Allerton. Then Dance walked into the interview room, and Overby's attention aimed that way. "Mr. Serrano, I'm Agent Dance." Her voice crackled through the overhead speaker in the observation room.
"Mister,"
Foster muttered. The Latino's eyes narrowed as he looked her over carefully.
"Good to meet you."
There was nothing nervous about his expression or posture, Overby noted. She sat across from him. "Appreciate your coming in." A nod of his head. Agreeable. "Now please understand you're not under investigation. I want to make that clear. We're talking to dozens of people, maybe hundreds. We're looking into gang-related crimes here on the peninsula and hope you can help us."
"Deaver shows us exactly how it's done and makes us admire his own literary artistry," says the New York Times. Jeffrey Deaver is an award-winning journalist and author. He received his BA in journalism from the University of Missouri and has a law degree from Fordham University. Since becoming a full-time writer in 1990, Deaver has written over 30 books. His work has been nominated for an Anthony Award, a Gumshoe Award, and 7 Edgar Awards. In 2004, he received the Ian Fleming Steel Dagger Award from the Crime Writers Association of Great Britain. He has also won the Ellery Queen Readers Award for Best Short Story 3 times. His novels have appeared on a number of bestseller lists, including the New York Times, the London Times, and the Los Angeles Times. Many of his novels have also been made into films. In 1999, his book, The Bone Collector, was made into a major motion picture starring Denzel Washington. For more information about top-selling titles from this award-winning company, go to downpour.com.
"Well, I'm tired of being a fool, and my mind goes hot to cool. Trying to conform to others' ideas and somebody else's rules. The life I'm living ain't mine. I'm supposed to feel that's fine. I didn't make the world I'm living in."
Get behind Now Stay There is a Just Imagine It Inc. presentation and was recorded in the Blackstone Audio Inc. studios in Ashland, Oregon. If you would like more information about this show, or if you or someone you know would like to be featured, please call us at 541-708-0525 or visit justimagineitinc.com. I'm Maya Seligman.
I'm Sarah Simerson.
I'm Jerry Renfro.
I'm Holly Lorian Adams.
I'm Sean Mark Nipper.
And I'm Charlie Stanton, and we like you, so be sure to like us on Facebook, and remember to get behind me.
Now stay there.
You have a moves that need.